It is terrible that victim families had to turn to the courts to find justice, and terrible, too, that the poor and working families of dioceses throughout the nation will suffer from the cost of the lawsuits and thus receive less assistance from the church they depend on. The hierarchy of the American church has lost a great deal of its authority, and it will be a long time, a generation perhaps, I think, before it gains it back. But, as in all things, there is some good here. Here, at least, is a hope. There is a new generation of new priests rising. These new priests hate the old ways. They hate the compromises and corruption of the past. They want to be heroic. I have met them. I know them. They entered the priesthood out of belief and ardor. They, in fact, went into the priesthood against the flow of history, with no societal encouragement and few obvious rewards. They went into it, and are going into it, at a time of scandal when it has never been harder to be a priest. These are the ones that will help right the American church. More hope. The seminaries and orders that have most in the past 30, 40 years embraced evil ways are dying. Very few people are joining them. Those that have not, those seminaries that have not embraced evil ways, are growing now, and they're also beginning, they're starting. This is truly a happy case of survival of the fittest. The damage done to the church hierarchy may, just may, raise the standing of the clergy who have been largely untouched by the scandal, and that is American nuns. An old nun told me recently that, in her view, one reason the sex scandal happened is that nuns and priests, who used to work fairly closely together many times, don't work so closely together anymore. She said, "Peggy, we weren't there to watch them." Nuns used to be there, watching what was going on in the cardinal's house, serving as a corrective to the cardinal's thinking. Not so much anymore, and there are fewer nuns in any case. But if I were one of the men running the church, for sheer public relations reasons alone, I'd start elevating the nuns in this area and conferring with them seriously. There are some who complain, and they are right, that various convents in America have also become fairly disturbed in various ways, but not all, and so many nuns are true unknown and unsung heroes. And in any case, I think I've noticed a crude and imperfect, but rather serviceable way to judge which women's religious communities work, are constructive and faithful, and which are not. Here's the handy reference. The more old-fashioned the habit, the more Catholic the nun. The more distinctive the dress, the more removed from the world, and the more faithful. A nun in a veil is probably praying. A nun in a two-piece suit with nothing on her head but a little gray crew cut is somewhat more likely to be thinking of spirit winds and new ways to refer to Jesus as she. Nothing helps the world more than good nuns, and perhaps this is a good time even to upgrade their title. They are called sisters, when in fact they are mothers, for they mother children in schools and young girls in trouble. They mother great institutions like Covenant House in New York and the Sisters of Life in New York. They are as much mothers to the flock as priests are fathers, even in some cases more. So, I think goodbye, sister, hello, mother. The American church has learned a terrible and costly lesson. Errant priests can no longer assume they won't be found out, that's good news, and corrupt bishops can no longer be confident that they won't be exposed, that's good news too. The church has a beautiful opportunity to renew itself. As the respected churchman Cardinal Avery Dulles said in the spring of 2003, the American church is in urgent need of what he called far-reaching intellectual, spiritual, and moral regeneration. He told a crowd in the Bronx that the church has been swept by confusion, a lack of religious knowledge. It's been swept by dissent and decline. He slammed the immoral behavior of Catholics, both lay and clergy. He said it was a cause of scandal. Indeed it is, but one senses things are changing, for they must. I'm going to end this section with what I told the bishops. In September 2003, Cardinal Theodore McCarrick of Washington, Bishop Wilton Gregory, the head of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, and a handful of bishops met in Washington with a few dozen Catholic laymen to discuss the future of the church. The official name of the conference was A Meeting in Support of the Church. But everyone who was there really knew the context, and that was the scandals. 2 months before, in July, Cardinal McCarrick and Bishop Gregory, both very influential leaders in the American church, had held another meeting with laymen, but that meeting was kept secret. They had invited only those who might be characterized as church liberals. The story leaked, as such stories always do. There were a number of people who thought that holding a secret meeting to discuss a scandal born of secrecy was kind of tin-eared at best. The cardinal and the bishop were embarrassed. Those who are often characterized as conservative within the church asked for a similar meeting, and the two men obliged. The conservative meeting would not be a secret. I think in some small way the meeting was historic. The non-Catholic public would probably assume that bishops and cardinals frequently talk with conservatives in the church. The non-Catholic American public would probably assume bishops and cardinals are the conservatives in the church. But this is not really so. Conservatives in the church often feel that they are regarded, and not completely unkindly, as odd people who perhaps have a third hand growing out of their foreheads. We say, please, we must speak more as a church about the meaning of life. And church leaders respond, we may possibly do that after issuing the report on domestic employment policy. We ask the church to teach Catholic doctrine, and they point out that the press doesn't really like the church. It's all non sequitur. We ask them to discuss the pressing issues of the moment, such as cloning, which is a big coming issue. We are entering a world in which industrial fetal farms may soon grow replacement people for replacement parts. You can't get bigger as an issue than that. So we'll say, let's talk about that. And instead, the bishops and cardinals will issue new directives on how it would be better if people sang songs during the Mass after communion and hugged each other instead of shaking hands during the moment of peace. It's all conversation by non sequitur. Anyway, Bishop Gregory and Cardinal McCarrick met with the conservatives and heard them out for more than half a day. The conservatives assembled were earnest and informed. It was Princeton's Robert George who warned of a future that could include fetus farms. And it was all a pretty direct conversation, too, at least from one side. I had planned to speak on the teaching of Catholic doctrine, which is something the American Catholic Church doesn't really like to do in any depth, at least for the people in the pews. But it seemed to me that earlier speakers had so much to say on so many topics that are crucial and pending, that the great shame, the great scandals, were given surprisingly short shrift. So I rearranged my speech as others spoke. There were some central questions that motivated my remarks. I was wondering, do these men, the cardinal, the bishops, do they understand the extent and depth of the damage done by the scandal and is still being done by it? Do they understand that? Do they understand the church must move comprehensively to stop the scandal? To speak of a problem so difficult and yet so delicate, and to do it in front of men who lead the wounded church, and who came up through a system that we now know to have been marked by a certain degree of institutional sickness. This seemed to me Delicate is the best word I can come up with. And so I thought the only fair way to begin my remarks was to say that I meant to speak with candor, as one does when one speaks with friends, that we all love the church and we love Christ, and that candor demanded candor about myself, too. I didn't want to try to put myself above anybody. So I said that I spoke, truly enough, from no great moral height, and that I was certain I had the least impressive personal biography in the room, and that I was no moral exemplar, far from it. I said I wanted to make this clear because who we are both as individual people and as a church, who we really are, is at the heart of things. At this point, as I spoke, I happened to look at Cardinal McCarrick, who was sitting in the front row just a few feet from me. He nodded his head and he gave me a smile as if to say, "Oh, we're all imperfect. Don't worry here." I felt his sweetness. I felt his encouragement. And then I said my piece. I told them the scandal was, in my view, the worst thing ever to happen in the history of the American church. I told them they had to stop it now and deal with it fully, that if reports of abusive priests continue to dribble out over the next 2, 4, and 6 years, it will be terrible. It could kill the church. I spoke of how terrible it was that just the other day, a priest in Maine, just the other day, was finally removed from his parish 2 years. 2 years after it was revealed that he was one of the priests who had set up the pornographic website St. Sebastian's Angels. I told them, 2 years after he was found to be doing what he was doing, he's still in business. I attempted to paint a picture of a man in the suburbs of America taking his kids to church. He stands in the back in his Gap khaki slacks and his plaid short-sleeved shirt. He stands there holding his 3-year-old child. He's there every Sunday. He is loyal and faithful. But afterwards, away from the church, with his friends, at the barbecue, at the lunch, he now feels free to say things about the church that only 10 years ago would have been shocking. He thinks the church is largely populated by sexual predators, men whose job now is to look after their own. And then perhaps he adds, "But not my priest." Only maybe these days he doesn't say, "But not my priest," so often. And so I said, we must move. We use buzzy phrases from the drug wars like zero tolerance for sexual predators, but maybe we should use words that reflected who we are and where we stand, like defrocking and excommunication. They are good words that speak of who we are as a church. I told the bishops and the cardinal that we were a demoralized church. And, I told them this was hard to say, they too must feel demoralized. I said, I imagine a leader of our church. He became a priest to help humanity, to bring it Christ. And he became a priest and did great work and rose to a position of leadership. And now he is in the meeting where the archdiocese lawyer muscles the single mother who brought suit against the local priest who molested her son after she took the boy to the priest so he could have a good male role model and learn of the greatest male role model, Jesus Christ. So, we are demoralized. But I said, there is help. I spoke of the scene in Mel Gibson's movie The Passion, which I knew some in the audience had seen in screenings. Mel Gibson had attempted, obviously, to base his film on the Gospels, but there were a few moments in which his art and his imagination asserted themselves, and he just did it his way. There was one scene like this that, for me, was the great moving moment of the film. The beaten and brutalized Christ falls under the weight of the cross. He's half dead. He's on his way to Golgotha. When he falls, his mother runs to help him, and he looks up at her with blood streaming down his face, and he says, "See, Mother, I make all things new again." I quoted this dialogue to the bishops and the cardinal, and when I said the words, "Christ spoke in the film," my voice broke, and for a few seconds I couldn't continue speaking. I don't know why this happened. Cardinal McCarrick looked at me very kindly. He has a kind face. I was embarrassed, but at the same time I thought, well, okay. What choked me up was thinking of Jesus and thinking of how we all want to be new again, and we can be if we rely on him, but it's so hard, and deep in our hearts, while we believe, we do not believe, we could not believe, or else we'd all be new again. Anyway, I regained my composure, and I concluded my remarks with some hard advice. I said the leaders of the church should now, tomorrow, first thing, take the mansions they live in and turn them into schools for children who have nothing, and take the big black cars they ride in and turn them into school buses. I noted that we were meeting across the street from the Hilton Hotel, and I said it would be good for them to find out where the cleaning women at the Hilton live, and go live there, in a rent-stabilized apartment on the edge of town or in the suburbs. Take the subway to work like the other Americans, and talk to the people there. How moved they would be to see a prince of the church on the subway. They would talk to you about their problems of faith, I said. They could tell you how hard it is to reconcile the world with their belief and faith, and you could say to them, "Buddy, ain't it the truth?" I didn't know if my comments had hit their mark until the meeting was over, when a round and intelligent-looking bishop approached me as I waited on the sidewalk for a cab. I was trying to rush to the airport and make the next shuttle home. The bishop said to me, "I'd give you a ride, but I don't have the limo." I laughed, but now I think perhaps I should have said, "You will, baby, you will." I was asked privately after the speech if I meant to suggest the church should divest itself of its beautiful art and cathedrals and paintings and gold filigree. No way. We are not Puritans. We are not Protestants. Catholicism is, among other things, a sensual faith, and it is our way to love and celebrate the beautiful. Moreover, regular people have as much access to the finery of churches, the great art, etc., as the rich and powerful, and that's how it's supposed to be. Art is aspirational. It helps us reach. But the princes of our church no longer need to live in mansions in the center of town. Those grand old homes were bought and built a century ago, in part so the political and cultural leaders of our democracy would understand that the Catholic Church was here and had arrived. But they know it now. The point has already been made. Cardinals are shepherds. Shepherds live on hills. They do not live in mansions. In the end, the response from the bishops and the cardinal was not really clear to me. They did not refer to any of my points in their remarks or speak to me afterwards. I don't imagine any of the laymen left the meeting with a feeling that great progress had been made in any particular area. I left with a feeling that some progress may have been made in some area. I didn't come away angry, as I know some did. I didn't come away depressed, either. I came away glad that I'd said what I thought needed saying. And I also, in the end, felt somewhat perplexed, and I guess it was a little tinged by sadness. I felt, why would all this be happening? What does God want us to do? And how can flawed and ridiculous people like us help? Someone at the meeting quoted the historian Paul Johnson, who said some years back to a new Catholic, "Come on in, it's awful." We all laughed, but you know, I think it was the one thing everyone in that room agreed on.